promotion while a war veteran at Columbia University here in New York. After Columbia, I continued my studies at the New School for Social Research, and during one of those courses, we were asked to read English newspapers so that we would be familiar with that other great civilized country, Great Britain, and I'd pick up an English newspaper once a week. And late 1962, winter of 62, I started to read about a group out of Liverpool called the Beatles who were creating a stir. And as the type print became larger and larger in the newspapers and the word Beatlemania appeared somewhere around January or February of 1963, I decided, or just instinctively felt, that maybe this could happen here. And I made a deal with Brian Epstein, and he says, Mr. Bernstein, how do you expect to do any business with my boys when there's no airplay? I said, there will be. There absolutely will be. I says, I'll make the deal with you not in the very near future. I'll do it a year hence. And that's how we did it, a year hence. The following February, I chose Lincoln's birthday because it's a holiday for kids here in school. It turned out to be a Wednesday, February 12th, 1964 at Carnegie Hall. I'm gonna tell it, man, about Uncle John.
He said he had to miss it, but he got a lot of fun, baby. The first time the Beatles arrived here, do you remember that day? Can you tell me something about what it was like? They really weren't expecting what they got when they landed here.
I was living in the village at the time. Took a cab up to my office in the morning, as I usually did. And as I was in the cab, the newscaster on the radio station was talking about a scene at Kennedy Airport. The Beatles were arriving that morning. He said, thousands and thousands of kids are at the airport. He says, it's a sight that he'd never seen. Presidents don't get it. Kings don't get it in their own countries. And I knew they were checking into the plaza that day. So I changed direction. Instead of going to my office, I asked the driver, would he drop me at the plaza? And then I saw a sight unlike any I had ever seen. A couple of thousand young people in front of the plaza, behind barricades, very well behaved, but a very enthusiastic, love-filled crowd, singing Beatles songs, waiting the arrival of the Beatles.
They were just like four boys, and I really liked them. They were good, they were real great guys. It didn't really hit me. And then you see them standing there singing, and I don't know what they do. They just change you. They're not what they used to be. They're just so much better.
Did you personally, as the promoter, do anything to drum up that hysteria, or was it in fact self-generated?
It was absolutely self-generated. I had little to do with the hysteria. I did work on the promotion of the records. I became a self-appointed promotion man when I bought them. My good friend was Ed Sullivan, who learned I had them and decided on a visit to London when he saw a crowd at the airport with banners and thought it was an animal act. And when he asked the airport attendant, what is this all about? The guy said, it's the four most important singers Britain's ever had. It's a quartet. He followed it up when he got home, learned that I had them February 12th and bought them for February 9th for the Ed Sullivan Show and February 16th. So when word got out that he bought them, and word also, of course, went out that they were coming to Carnegie Hall, DJs took cognizance of the fact that a British group finally was arriving here. It wasn't Frankie Vaughan or any of the, you know, middle-of-the-road people that used to come, Gracie Fields. But anyway, it was something new for the DJs that a pop group was coming here.
Can you tell me a bit about what happened at the hotel? Any unusual incidents?
Yeah, there were instances like this. Some girls bought maids' outfits, came up with brushes to brush the room, clean the rooms. Some girls hid themselves in closets. Some boys bought bellhop uniforms so that they could deliver messages to them. It was the girls, though, who were the most ingenious. Some slipped into pillowcases if they were small and became a pillow. And I would guess at least a dozen were found in those rooms, either as pillowcases or in a dresser drawer. It was the funniest thing in the world. They were treated very gently, but asked to leave.
Now, you were in probably one of the best positions of all, because at the time, nobody really knew who Sid Bernstein was in that mob of teenagers. They didn't know that you knew the Beatles, because as I remember it, anybody who had actually even touched one of their hands was ripe to get his arm taken off by souvenir hunters.
Yeah, the most fascinating thing was, not the first concert I did at Carnegie Hall, but the next year at Shea Stadium, we had about 15 to 20 kids, girls, on stretchers in the first aid room who had passed out emotionally or got a little hysterical. I came in at the end of the concert, and one of the aides called out my name, and all of a sudden about 8 of the girls got well, jumped up, and they did almost yank my arm off.
The best things in life are free, but you can keep them for the best, and please now give me more.
Did you say that you got a real good deal? Did you get them cheap because they weren't known very well here?
In that first phone call to Brian Epstein, I had no conception, really, of what I was going to do with them, where I was going to play them. It was just a very, very strong hope and a desire on my part to be first with them in the United States or North America, you know. And when he said, where would you play them? I said, just ad-lib Carnegie Hall, where I had experience of doing some acts like Tony Bennett, Stan Getz, Sarah Vaughan, other acts that I had presented there. He says, my, he says, I like that. He had seen a picture called Carnegie Hall on BBC TV and was familiar with the tradition and of all the great artists who had played there, but classical artists. He says, you really want to bring my boys in there? I said, yes, that's my plan. And that helped win him over, the fact that I was thinking of Carnegie Hall. And I offered him $6,500 for two shows. And he said to me, that's more than we get in England. We average about $2,000 a show.
Tell me about that Shea Stadium concert. Was there anything unusual that happened that you might remember?
A little head appeared over one of the fences way outfield. And this little head got larger as the shoulders showed. And all of a sudden, all the attention was taken away from the Beatles to see if that little head was going to climb over that wall. And it did, and made the jump. And how that boy did not break his ankles and came running across the field to the cheers of 56,000 people who wanted him to make the stage, which was on second base. And the cops, of course, stopped him. And he was carried out gently but firmly out of the concert. But he almost made it.
Goodbye, Ruby Tuesday. Who could hang a name on you when you change with every new day? Still I'm gonna miss you.
Tell me about some of the other groups you brought over, because the Beatles were really the first biggies, but they were a lot to follow.
Right after the Beatles, I sort of led the British invasion of North America. I got on to the Rolling Stones and brought them first, again to Carnegie Hall. The crowd was so rowdy that I was asked never to come back to Carnegie Hall again. And so I brought the next group, Dave Clark Five, to the New York Paramount. And then the next group, the Animals. And then followed Herman's Hermits, the Kinks, the Moody Blues, Manfred Mann, and a few others.
You don't bring me flowers anymore.
Were you ever wrong about a group? You turned down and said, nah, they'll never be a hit, and then later on they went on into stardom?
I was wrong about individuals. I passed on Neil Diamond. I passed on Barbra Streisand. I passed on Paul Simon.
Can I ask why?
I think I was so content with the experience of the Beatles. And at that point I was having babies in a very quick time. I had six children, one after the other. It gave me all the fulfillment I needed.
Presenting now.
There are six new young artists that I've been working with for a while. One is a young lady who's going to be a huge star.
And her name is?
Her name is Laura Branigan. And probably, for me, the finest talent I've been touched by since the Beatles.
Nice,
writes beautifully. She sings in a very stirring, feeling way. More feeling than anyone that I know out there working today.
Do you have a most unforgettable character that you've met?
I would say it was Jimi Hendrix, who parked his car in the same garage that I parked mine in the building that I lived in. He didn't live there, but he lived in the neighborhood. And he come roaring into that garage, almost knocking whoever was in there down. It was a good drive. He knew just when to stop in his little sports car, always with two attractive, not one, but two attractive young women with him. And an awfully nice man, awfully decent man. I looked at him. I was sad for him. I felt that he was on bad habits, and I didn't know that he didn't have much time to live, but I really felt sad for him, for all the success and all the pretty ladies on his arm.
And similarly, do you have a most unforgettable moment in your career?
I would say the most unforgettable moment of my career was sitting with five or six of my children in a New York hotel ballroom where Beatle fans were having a convention, and I was invited to speak at it. And I knew that the film of Shea Stadium, the hour-long film that Brian Epstein and Ed Sullivan shot of the first Shea Stadium concert, was going to be shown. And my children, who grew up on, you know, your daddy did the Beatles, and we sat in this crowded ballroom on the floor and watched it together. I would say that's the moment.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Mm-hmm. A visit with Sid Bernstein, a North American who played an important role in the music patterns of the 60s.
Stand by for Trish Wood's report on America's moral majority and Canada's renaissance. Is liberty at stake? We all get a chance to judge when Sunday returns.